Our mission is a simple one. ERA 5050 want to see women represented on stage and screen in equal numbers to men.
Here, on the New ERA podcast, we will be talking to the women and men of the moment who are working towards equality, celebrating their success and discussing the solutions we can use to help move the industry forward.
Welcome to episode 4 of the New ERA podcast. I'm Ellie Yates.
And I'm Rose Riley. And this week, I headed up to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We've got loads to share with you about who we spoke with and what we saw and the discussions that arose out of the trip.
Unfortunately, I had to stay at home in London this week. But through the magic of FaceTime, we spoke to our partners in activism, Powerplay. Rose saw some incredible shows and took part in a panel discussion hosted by Persistent and Nasty in association with Civil Disobedience.
Yes, so Persistent and Nasty are a Glasgow-based script reading, debate and art as activism initiative for women and gender minorities in the stage and screen industries. And they asked ERA 5050 to send a representative, which is why I went along. And some of the other panellists included Kirsten Vangsness, Hannah Lavery and Keris Ellery. And all three of them had shows on at the Fringe and spoke about being a woman in the industry and being a woman at the Fringe and how we can move things forward.
So if you like the sound of that but you also couldn't be there, luckily they recorded the whole panel discussion for their own podcast, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes for you. So without further ado, let's jump in with our interview this week, which was with Roberto and Sophia from Powerplay. We discussed the surprising results of their 2018 study into gender at the Fringe and what they are looking at this year.
Powerplay is an award-winning activist theatre company. They use guerrilla-style immersive theatre, exciting new writing and data activism to combat gender inequality in UK theatre, challenging the arts industry to diversify the stories they tell. In 2018, they conducted the world's first piece of research that looks at gender inequality and the gender pay gap at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And on publishing it this year, they uncovered some pretty shocking results. We have with us today Powerplay's co-founder and artistic director, Sophia Compton.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have co-founder and head of research, Roberto Valdo-Cortese.
Hello.
Welcome to the New ERA podcast. We are actually, the three of us are here in the Assembly Room Club Bar, and Ellie is calling in from London. Hi, Ellie.
Hello. I'm calling in from a very sunny London.
So,
yes.
You were saying that this is much quieter Edinburgh than it was for you last year.
Yeah, I think you were right when we were chatting before and saying that we might be the only people. We've been walking around saying, God, it's been so nice being up here. It's been a really relaxing experience. Like, I feel zen.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think you're right in that.
No one feels like that normally.
That's incredible. It's definitely not the experience that I've ever had at the Fringe. But yeah, we've always had plays. Both of us have only ever come up with plays. And last year, not only did we have one play, we had four plays. And we also ran our own venue, which was a pop-up, and we also conducted this research, and so we were running around like crazy, and so this year we're like breathing.
What plays did you have on last year?
So we had Somebody by Matilda Curtis, cool. Funeral Flowers by Emma Dennis Edwards,
which award winning
won Fringe first,
and a Philippa Braganza award.
And a Philippa Braganza award, then we had Next Time by Jess Moore and The Empty Chair by Polly Creed.
Cool.
So how long have you guys been going as a company? And what inspired you to form?
So we've existed as a company for only 1 year. So it's been quite an explosive ride. Like the creation of Powerplay was inspired by a study that was run by Elizabeth Freestone in 2012, when she looked at the 10 biggest theatres in the country in terms of funding. And she worked out that there were two men for every woman. So we ran a similar study at UCL and worked out that women were leaving the drama society more quickly than men, etc., etc. And we decided, oh, okay, maybe some change could be implemented at university level. And this is when we were still students. And so that's when the idea came up in our mind. But it was only a couple of years after graduating that we actually implemented it.
Also, because I joined a little bit later, but I think what came out of that first internal UCL study was also the realisation that when you are confronted with the data on an issue, for example, the gender breakdown or gender pay gap, it really reframes how you understand the space that you're operating in. And it can be really easy to wander around and have no idea that these inequalities are happening, because you just don't... You know, you can have a sense for it, but when you see the numbers, I think often it changes how you understand your experience. So knowing I was at UCL in the Drama Society and I didn't realise how gender unequal it was, I just didn't notice, which is kind of ridiculous.
What came first, wanting to do the research, or were you making work first, or was it a mixture of both?
I think they both happened totally together. And I think that it was really important for us to do both. And we wanted to... I think that we had a couple of moments in the year leading up to last year where it was a real kind of grow or shrink situation, where we realised that the project that we were kind of... that was emerging was getting bigger and bigger. But we really wanted to come into this space having done student productions here, and understand, not only bring up work that we really supported and we thought approached being at the Fringe in a slightly different way by creating a site-specific showcase and by creating a showcase so there's multiple works, but also that actually got a bit under the skin of what the Fringe experience was, because we'd all been here and we know how valuable it is as a platform. We'd experienced that already, but we also knew how difficult it was. I think... because a lot of companies do come through the Fringe, it's almost forgotten how much of an enormous task it is and how hard it is. So it wasn't something that we wanted to just do lightly. We wanted to try and get as much out of that experience as possible.
And I think there was really a sense of... well, all of us are particularly interested in political theatre and activism, and we all had a sense that often... platforming, you know, female talent isn't enough, and doing political theatre often isn't enough. And actually, you need to go beyond the stage and do, you know, activist work outside. And so it felt necessary also do the data activism alongside the plays.
Yeah, I think also we wanted to do what we could in the theatre industry, but it's such a, you know, that's a massive task. We thought, what can we actually contribute? The area which we have experience, so therefore we understand, was the Fringe. And also, in a way, the Fringe seemed to be an important place that hadn't been part of the conversation around, especially gender, in the theatre industry, because what we'd found from this Freestone study was this... the 2-to-1 problem in the top of the industry, where there's 2 men for every woman and kind of fewer in some areas. It's like 23% of creative crews as a whole at that point. And that is a couple of years old now, but it seems to be still the case. And we realised that it's very important for activists in general to get a sense of the kind of steps that lead up to that. And we know that the problem exists at the top, but does the problem exist also at the kind of emerging field? And therefore the Fringe, even though it's so massive, but it's also a specific space, like it happens for 1 month a year, so it is a space that you can actually investigate to kind of see one of those building blocks.
So looking at your 2018 study, which is super impressive and threw up some really fascinating things, one of the most shocking is that on average men were earning 60% more than women on the Fringe. Is that right? So with men earning an average of £523 and women £326, that's a significant gap. And that is for the whole festival, right? That's the average...
Yeah, not just for the whole festival, it's also... and this speaks for the working conditions and how poorly people are paid. This is for the whole festival plus the rehearsal period in advance.
Yeah.
This is this 60% pay gap emerges after controlling for a wide range of variables, So it's quite a robust figure.
I think also it's important to note that that is happening despite the fact that we also found that the Fringe is a gender equal platform. And
representation wise.
Yeah, in terms of representation. And in terms of the category of theatre, it's actually 60% female. So it's actually female dominated. Mm. It's not even the case that the Fringe is a completely male dominated space. It's a female dominated space in the theatre world. Mm. And yet this massive pay inequality is operating.
Which is then interestingly linked to the 2-to-1 problem that Elizabeth Freestone found, because suddenly the narrative that emerges from our study is that the Fringe has this massive pool of female talent, and yet obstacles are already emerging at the start. And so it's no surprise that if you look further after, in the bigger stages, then those numbers have dropped. And perhaps one of the reasons is this gender earnings gap.
So when I was reading your research and saw that stat, my question was like, why do you think women drop off after something like The Fringe? So talent and skill is kind of being nurtured at The Fringe, and people come here to make work and grow their careers. Why do you think that drops off?
I think what's come out of the study specifically is that we need to ask that question. So, you know, I don't think we have a clear answer right now. I mean, I have some thoughts, but I think that the study has revealed that we need to find out where are those pressure points. One thing that you can look into, looking at what is happening at the Fringe, I think it's not only a gender earnings gap. It's not actually specifically about the money. It's also about the amount of workload, you know, to pay kind of ratio in a sense, and that culture of extreme overwork and the responsibility and time pressures and financial pressures that are being put on women's shoulders. And I think after a while, that just doesn't feel sustainable.
You can bankrupt yourself doing a couple of Fringes in a row, and if you're getting paid less, and plus the enormous costs of just being at the festival and accommodation and everything else, it affects who can come here, what kind of people can come here over and over again and fail again before they get the move to the next step.
Yeah, as Sophie is saying, I think if we look beyond the Fringe, it's very hard to answer the question, why is it? But whilst we don't have a specific answer, I think there is one argument that can be made with quite a lot of confidence, and I think that is that one of the reasons is that funding bodies aren't really putting money into discovering an answer to that question. So I am quite certain from the conversations that we're having with the Fringe Society that have now partnered with us with our 2019 study into class, etc., that after you get the numbers out, after people see, black and white, what the situation is, then it's easier to look at causes, affect change. And until you see those numbers, then it's impossible to change things. And so if funding bodies do not finance the research, then it's impossible to change things. So I don't know what the actual causes are, but I am quite certain of one of the key obstacles to identifying them.
I mean, even outside of gender, and you guys are picking up on that this year, right?
Yeah.
At the end, I mean, you found some incredible stats for actually how little people get paid for a Fringe show in general, regardless of gender. And so that not only limits who is doing the work, whether they're male or female, or non-binary, but also limits who, like what backgrounds people are coming from, who are bringing work, which limits the kind of work we're seeing in Edinburgh.
Absolutely. And I think that we're really grateful to be part of this ongoing discussion around the cost and the value of Edinburgh, which is also being looked at by other researchers, including Claire Stone. And that is emerging as the kind of the essential topic around this festival, is that it's not just what is happening within the Fringe space, it's like who is not able to be in the Fringe space. And I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that we find an over-concentration of women in a place that is so unregulated and so difficult. But I also think that we all need to be... it's clear for anyone at the Fringe to see, but the people who have absolutely no access to that platform whatsoever, it's just enormous. Like, you need such financial safety net. You need such a secure financial safety net to be here. But it really is a place where you can launch a career. So, yeah, it's pretty bad, actually.
So it's how many careers are we not launching is the question.
Exactly.
So, something that's, I think, emerged from the conversations that we've had this year with various change makers, producers here at the festival is that the festival is massively underfunded. And in particular, Arts Council England puts very, 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 very little money. So, you know, you look at it from the outside and the festival had been created as a platform to promote, you know, talent that couldn't get into the Edinburgh International Festival. But it has now become really quite exclusive to people who have the financial resources to come. And it seems quite systematic because there is an active decision not to fund it. Yeah, I think it's becoming really, as opposed to an industry issue, a political issue, because it's worth £200 million a year to the city of Edinburgh. It brings dozens of millions of pounds of tax revenue into HMRC, and it seems very difficult to understand why exactly the state doesn't put the money back so that people of all backgrounds can come here.
But then in a way... we think it should be more of a political issue rather than it is currently, because we think that that's actually quite a big story and that that is just not, simply not good enough. This is the second most ticketed event in the world after the Olympics, and it has like minimal support. So all of the kind of responsibility and the pressure is put on the shoulders of the practitioners. I think one of the reasons for that is that nobody... feels like they have the power to change the Fringe. Nobody feels like they have agency over it. I think all performers that are here are so distracted and focused, but of course, on just surviving, that they don't feel like they have any way of making change to the platform itself. I think the venues are under a lot of pressure themselves, and they're all struggling to get by with their very different business models, and there's no kind of strong consensus. You know, you can't bring a consensus even between the venues around exactly what's happening in there from their perspective. I think the Fringe Society as well is in a tricky position, because the premise of the Edinburgh Fringe is that it's an open access festival. But I think where we are coming at this is thinking we see the challenges from all the various angles, but we really do need to start working together and thinking about how we can solve this problem. Because at the end of the day, you can't really call a festival open access if only a very small amount of people can access it. So it just doesn't seem to live up to that in that principle in the way that it's working, which is incredibly unfunded, unregulated.
And if somewhere like Edinburgh is launching careers, then you've got... And the financial burden is on the practitioners and the artists, then you've got a real biased influx of work.
Absolutely.
That then goes on perhaps to the top line theatres or starts going back into the industry that's not the Fringe, that is funded by Arts Council. So actually the people who then have launched a career, who then may be applicable for Arts Council funding... were able to start their career because they had the funds to put their own stuff on at Edinburgh. So again, we're like, well, who's missing here? We've got a huge amount of people in the country who are not able to put on work and then don't get the airtime.
Exactly, and that's what we're trying to find out this year. That's exactly what we're looking at. So we're looking at class and race in particular, because we feel like it's very likely that there's going to be a real lack of representation in both of those areas. So we want to bring that hard data so that we can make that case even stronger.
So how are you going about the study this year? Is it the same kind of methods as you used for 2018 study, or
How are you collecting the data this year?
So it's quite it's a different approach, because last year we were looking at companies, so we were gathering information about how much is your company budget, how big is your expenditure, how many people are you employing, how many of these people are paid this much and this much, etc., etc. Whereas this year, because we're asking people about class, we're asking people about ethnicity, then it's about individual performance. So last year we gathered the data, we tried various data collection strategies, and eventually the one that really worked was at an event called Meet the Media, which is attended by a very large number of companies, and there's a large concentration of producers. But this year, because we were focusing on individuals, we tried a number of data collection strategies, and eventually the one that's now working is through an online survey, which we are distributing with like Facebook ads that are all built with our concerted strategy. The idea is that you see the ad and the ad says, oh, you can win £100 by filling in the survey. People are, to be honest, to our surprise, filling it in large numbers.
Nothing like a cash...
I've never filled in such a survey online, but people are doing it, and it
people
seems...
People are poor in Edinburgh.
Yeah. That's what it is. But it seems that the spread is pretty good as well, so... Yeah.
The hard thing is, obviously, with this kind of data collection is that you can't publicise it, because then you're skewing your own results. Yeah. So you just have to put it out there and hope for the best. That it's going to be picked up.
Yeah. Mm. And so we will get this data, and on the 1st of September we will give this £100 cash reward to courtesy of the Fringe Society to the lucky winner. And after that, what we will do is we will check this data against the results that we had from last year, against the Fringe catalogue, and we'll run a number of tests to see whether we had like selection issues or not. But then what we will do is we will send this data to an econometrician, and so someone who is really, really good at analysing it, and then we will get, hopefully, a very robust study again. Mm.
Do you have any expectations about what you're going to find? Or
we think that there are going to be very few people who are BAME, and it seems to be the case so far. We think that it's going to be a very white festival,
yeah,
and a very privileged festival. Mm-hmm. But it is, I think I'm most interested to see how that breaks down on the smaller things that we might be looking at. So, for example, last year we found a finding which I actually think is quite relevant to the discussion that we were having earlier around why is it that there are so many women at the fringe. And why, why is this gender pay gap operating? And it's kind of a surprising finding, and it's that the higher the ticket price, the higher the percentage of women on stage. So if the average ticket price is £8.87, if you double the price, the number of women increases by quite a large margin. It's those kind of small insights that you find when you're doing quite a big comprehensive study that then start, get you thinking. And one of the explanations for this, so there are many different, we don't know the answer as to why that is, but it seems possible that this is associated with whether women feel able to take financial risks versus men, and whether women feel able to kind of whether they feel confident in terms of like raising up their volume, raising up their ticket capacity, or just saying no, I'm not going to do it on these terms, and things like that.
Do you think that's what it shows? So that to me is interesting, but I would have no idea why. Do you think it shows that women are more confident in...
The point of this statistic is that we found that when there's a higher budget, you don't get higher wages. So when a production raises more money through ticket sales, it might be possible to hire more women because women are effectively cheaper. So that's right. One thing about what's happening at the fringe is that this picture of the money, the money not going to the performers, and it seems to be part of this kind of competitive space where everyone's desperately trying to make their production work, even to their own personal kind of detriment. But also, you know, if the ticket price goes up, it might be possible that men are negotiating higher wages. They're saying, hey, if we're going to charge £17, then I want to be paid X amount of money, whereas maybe women aren't doing that. It's also possible that men could be happy to lower their ticket prices so that they can be more competitive, and therefore they're taking more of a financial risk in that situation. So, I mean, it's impossible to say which of these factors is exactly contributing to this kind of quite surprising statistic. But there does seem, I think, this is my personal opinion, to be a correlation between budgets and where you see women working. And I am interested to find out, in looking beyond the fringe, whether there this sense that of men being a kind of more financially stable programming decision, for example, is also contributing to this. And if it's about when the budget goes up, you see less women, and why that might be. And I think there's a lot of different reasons.
That would be consistent with, like, with the very sad picture that we see outside of theatre, as well as in theatre, but I mean nationwide, which is that men tend to be paid more. And so that would mean that men can take more risk at the fringe because they are earning more outside of the fringe. In 2018, we didn't have data on this specific matter. We will in 2019, but that could be an explanation.
And in terms of kind of on a practical level, what do you hope that your research from last year and your research that's from this year will practically help with, I suppose, fringe makers and outside of the Edinburgh Fringe? Do you have any hopes for what it might change?
We want to put this issue onto the political agenda, essentially, and we want to get more subsidy into the fringe because it seems like this huge, terrifying task. You know, how are you going to get Arts Council England or whoever to give £6 million, which is, we've actually done, crunched the numbers on a very basic sense. And actually,
can't get enough of the numbers.
Can't get enough of the numbers. And we have realised that that is the figure that would allow, if you're going by Arts Council's, or the fact that they only fund 30% of the applications that they receive, and if you're continuing that kind of number, that would fund all eligible professional shows at the Fringe on equity rates. It feeds the theatre industry, and it's not subsidised.
And feeds the theatre industry across the whole country. I mean,
internationally.
And most importantly, it literally feeds Edinburgh and you know, the wider economy, because, you know, it feeds us professionally, and it feeds us in terms of our souls, and you know, our creative goals can, you know, be fulfilled here. But in terms of real money, it's you know, who benefits is Edinburgh. There are a number of reports about these 200 million figures. You know, this is money that landlords get through renting their rooms at triple the price. This is money that's spent in restaurants. You know, it's got an economic value. And, I mean, to me, it's just crazy to think that the second largest ticketed event in the world after the Olympics, the largest arts festival in the world, doesn't get, you know, substantial investments from the government. It's not just morally wrong, it doesn't make economic sense. And this is why we see this as a political issue. Currently, performers of all sorts of backgrounds are being excluded from this platform. The performers that can come to this platform are losing a lot of money and performing under very stressful conditions so that the wider economy can benefit. Well, the wider economy needs to put the money back.
Yeah.
If you have a completely unregulated free market, which is what the Edinburgh Fringe is, well, it's no surprise that the usual winners and losers of the labour market emerge, which is, you know, women's work is undervalued and people of BME backgrounds tend to be less represented, because these are the problems that we have to fix elsewhere.
Yeah.
So if we have a structure where we don't have all of the reforms that we've put in place over decades, then of course things are going to look terrible, and that's the current situation. So it's political.
It's also about the work culture that emerges when people are working under such difficult conditions. And there's a huge issue around mental health and mental well-being at the fringe, and there's the strain that this kind of pressure puts on people as performers, physically, mentally, in all senses, is huge. But also how there was one of the most interesting studies that we have found in our research has been the Nordicity 2017 Workplace Review, which is also looks into how the theatre industry in the UK, it looks at the role of networking within it, and how the kind of fast-paced system where you need to hire someone really quickly, and the lack of structure and the lack of process means that it's like the same people get the same jobs time and again, and the same people are excluded time and again. And that kind of frantic bubble hiring practice is exactly what you see at the fringe. And that is no individual company or no individual company's fault by any means. It's because everyone's struggling. There's no ability to like go through things with a process. There's no opportunity to take time over big decisions. So mistakes happen, and you hire your friends, and etc. etc. And then that work culture is, as the Nordicity study shown, replicated throughout the industry.
Mm. And so you're saying that proper funding would be a solution to lots of these problems?
Definitely, yeah. Because it would enable people to do things properly. It would enable someone to actually cast their show rather than desperately searching for anyone that might be prepared to share a bed with them on the floor in some flat which you're like 15 people in two rooms. You can't hire someone, and you definitely can't hire someone when you feel like there's an inequality of opportunity already existing, when you feel like you're essentially trying to hire someone to exploit them, you know. It's not possible.
And it's also, if we fund something like the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, you open up a space for much more diverse work that we're also missing,
yes,
in our main theatres.
Yes,
absolutely.
Well, one way, and this is just one of the ideas in the air, is to create more of a pocket within the fringe. So you can still have whoever wants to come up and pitch up and do their thing and lose whatever money they want to lose, you know, that could still exist, and that free fringe spirit can still exist all the way around it. But, you know, essentially there is this pocket within the fringe already that is a much more professional space, and that is being limited massively by this unwillingness to open up the conversation around funding or curation.
This is consistent with the conversations that we were having earlier about the fringe being theoretically open access, but in reality, Summer Hall isn't open access.
No.
Assembly isn't open access. Pleasance isn't open access. You know, all of these big established venues where we all want to perform, well, they don't have open access programs. You have to apply, they'll check, they'll see your track record. Mm. Last year, we applied to Summer Hall, and they were really lovely. They said, oh, these ideas sound amazing, but you don't have a track record, so it's maybe we are not the best space yet. And it makes complete sense. But so this just shows that...
Another barrier.
Well, it's not, it's not so much about it being a barrier. It's the fact that this idea of the fringe being open access, fully open access, is wrong. There are two separate fringes, one that is professional and expects a certain standard.
And quite rightly.
Quite rightly.
Yeah.
And then there is the general adventurous fringe that everybody talks about. But if there is this first professional space, then we should put the money where our mouths are.
Yeah.
Another thing that your study found kind of on that is that that men platform men and women platform women. So, you know, if it's a female writer or a female artistic director or director, it's more likely to have fairer representation on stage. Is that right? That's what you found, yeah?
Yeah, so basically what we did is we, through a number of statistical techniques, we checked what factors affect the ratio of men to women in a cast. We were, amongst the things that we were trying to look at, we were trying to see, okay, do big shows with a bigger budget have more or less women in, etc., etc. And it turns out that those variables do not have so much of an effect. What has an effect, whether the artistic director of the company is a man or a woman, and if it's a man, you'll have more men, and if it's a woman, you'll have more women. I can't remember the exact stats. It's about 20-25% more. Same thing for a playwright. If it's a man, then you'll have more men. If it's a woman, you have more women. And then it's the ticket price. So if the ticket price is more expensive, then you'll have more women, as we discussed earlier. As a result of these findings, what we discovered is that you have a male artistic director and a male playwright, and you've got an averagely priced play, you'll have roughly 69% men and 31% women. Mm. And instead,
that's that 2-to-1 ratio. Mm.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. If it's instead, you know, female artistic director, female playwright, and an averagely priced play, you'll get roughly 20% men and 80% women. Mm. So as a result of this, what emerges is a picture where suddenly, if you let companies free to operate as they see fit, where you have male artistic directors and male playwrights, the 2-to-1 problem emerges. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The vast majority of theatre companies, the vast majority of NPOs are run by men. Many studies that show that the vast majority of playwrights showcased are men.
Yeah.
And so, guess what? The 2-to-1 problem emerges. Yeah. So it's all consistent.
And also that 2-to-1, I looked at the artistic directors just to see, I wonder if it has changed in the last 7 years or however long it's been since Elizabeth Freestone. And guess what? It's 2 out of the top 10, the artistic directors of the 10 most funded NPOs are women. Mm-hmm. So it's gone down, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is interesting, because if we're saying that Edinburgh is female-heavy in terms of creatives, so if we're looking at these stats, then you're going to have more female performers.
Yeah.
Because if we've got also female-led projects, then you've also then got extremely underpaid workforce of Edinburgh. So we're talking about, if we're looking at your statistics, the majority of the Edinburgh Fringe, if it is female, are underpaid. Mm-hmm. And then they're going into an industry outside of the Fringe that is male-heavy, so where are the women going?
Yeah.
And a lack of opportunity there.
So that is the exact question, you know, where do the women go after the Fringe? And that's one of the, you know, ongoing big pieces of research that we have coming up. I don't know how much...
It's exactly, I wonder what organization. So we are partnering with ERA to work out exactly the answer to that question. So yes, but so these results I think show, you know, very clearly the argument to have a really diverse representation in leadership positions across the industry. If you have more female artistic directors and more female playwrights platformed, then these findings suggest that representation will automatically fix itself, because these are the stories that we platform.
Before, thank you so much for all of that. It's so, so interesting. But before you go, what are your... this is hopefully going to be coming out soon. So what are your tips for people who haven't yet booked up their Fringe? Is there anything that they definitely... desperately need to see and try and get a ticket to?
Honestly, just get your hands on any tickets that are still going at the Traverse. Everything I've seen there has just blown me away. And yeah, I really loved, really recommend Sex Education at Summer Hall. Really recommend The Slinks, Underbelly. So much, though. It's impossible to choose.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the latest show by Ship Theatre, which is about expat culture in Malta specifically, and you know, the distant migrant crisis. It's really well observed. And then I thought that How Not to Drown was really, really incredible.
Which we're going to see later today.
Can't wait.
Last but not least, you had a mad Fringe last year.
Mm-hmm.
Any tips on surviving the Fringe?
I think this is something that probably no one would ever do, and I did not do. Speaking from not experience, don't come to the Fringe too early. The Fringe is such an amazing platform, and we were really lucky last year, but it was hectic. And I think you can get so much out of the Fringe if you're coming with a little bit longer into your journey as a company, when you've had a little bit more experience under your belt and you kind of know what you want to get out of it a bit more, and you're able to, and your idea, the story that you're developing, it can be totally a fresh new piece of work. But, you know, don't just come up having never performed it ever before. It's just stressful. And I don't think that that's the best way of getting the most out of this amazing opportunity, and it would be frustrating to come up and realize that you could have got so much more out of it if you'd spent a little bit more time beforehand getting yourself to a place where you were ready for it.
I completely agree with Sophie's advice. I think in general my advice would be, don't believe in the American dream. So, you know, the story that if you work hard enough and if you are lucky enough, et cetera, you might just become the new Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Well, you know, the truth is, in reality, the odds are really, really, really skewed against you. And so to come to the Fringe, you really have to have a really good budget. You really need to have good PR, and you need to have a nice strategy that sets you apart. We say we were lucky that we got a Fringe first. But then again, we were running our own venue. We had 4 shows. We were supported by Clean Break. We had, you know, quite a large budget for Fringe standards. We were paying people far more than the average Fringe show pays. So, of course, it was easier. It was really hard, but...
Yeah.
So my advice is, come to the Fringe only when you're ready, and don't take your chances. Mm. Don't play the lottery.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to
Such
us.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's fantastic research and what you're doing, and we can't wait to hear the findings of the next lot of research. So.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful Fringe.
Yeah.
So a massive thanks to Roberto and Sophia for coming to talk to me, and to the Assembly Room Club Bar, who let us sit in, I think, their whiskey room at kind of 10 a.m. in the morning when it was a lot quieter than it was the night before, and letting us do the interview there. So thanks very much for letting us use the space.
So every episode we want to champion women's stories, work that promotes 50-50 casting and creative teams. And there is so much wonderful work like this at The Fringe, as discussed with Roberto and Sophia, that we were spoilt for choice with what to talk to you about.
Mm. One of the noticeable things at The Fringe this year was the increase of plays that centre around activism, which is obviously very appropriate for this episode. So I gathered some audience responses after I went to see Who Cares?, which was written by Matthew Woodhead and produced by Lung Theatre, and is a moving verbatim play about young carers in Salford. And Anguis, the debut play by Olivier Award-winning actress Sheila Atim and directed by Lucy Jane Atkinson. Anguis is set in a broadcast recording studio where an interview exploring alternatives to popular truth takes place between two women, the great pharaoh Cleopatra and contemporary virologist Kate.
It is the work that Lung Theatre make. It's obviously for communities, with communities, and tells stories that really need to be told. And it is probably the most powerful piece of theatre I've seen this Fringe. Everybody should come and see it.
I think I cried all the way through. I work at Gaddam, and we manage the Salford Carer Service, and I took over from Paul, who was mentioned in the play, and he helped with the creation of the play. So it's quite an emotional thing for me to come in and see it, because I've heard so much about it. I've read the play, but I was never lucky enough to see it, so to actually finally see it tonight, and because I know some of the young people in it and some of the characters in the play, it was very, very emotional. Yeah, it was great, really, really good.
My daughter is registered as a young carer because of her brother, so it's something that I'm very aware of, and it was quite an emotional journey for both me and my husband to go through. But it's a piece of work that everyone should see.
So it was really powerful. I thought the young actors were incredible. I was almost really conscious all the way through that it was actually testimony from real young people. So it's fantastic.
You're aware that there aren't support services for young people who are carers, but to actually hear testimony that's verbatim just brought it across in a really powerful and shocking way.
I think exposing hidden things in society is always really, really crucial. Made me realise we are all responsible and we should all be morally ready to take some kind of action.
When it toured originally, it went to quite a lot of schools in Salford and it helped identify over 100 new young carers who, through watching the play or through professionals seeing the play, they were like, oh, that's such a buddy from our class, or that's me, that's my experiences.
It came about from people telling stories, so I think it's one of the best ways that you can sort of raise issues and stuff like that.
This little bit of art can make big changes.
I've read that issue plays have increased a small percentage this year at Edinburgh, and I think that they've got to increase more as the years go by, because then we can get something done.
I think it's an essential piece of work that's massively important, incredibly powerful and incredibly well done. Vital, powerful and heartbreaking.
Really, really good show. Yeah. Very deep, yeah. Yeah. To the bone marrow.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Like,
you're gonna make me cry again.
I thought it was phenomenal. I mean, the music, the acting, it was phenomenally written.
Yeah.
Just very beautiful, yeah.
I was really interesting in a shorter play that I thought was like small p political, like not dealing with political parties necessarily, but dealing with like raw and necessary conversations that themselves have power. And I thought that play encapsulated that perfectly.
I really felt like art. Like there was so many different issues in there. It really speaks to my experience sometimes when we're trying to do the right thing in the world, that there are those voices who keep saying, well, you're not going to be able to change it, or you just have to accept how it is.
There are moments these days where I feel like it's very hard to win, that whatever we do, it's either the system that is pushing us down, or ourselves, or each other, and I think that sometimes it can feel very oppressive to have this label of being a strong woman that doesn't necessarily allow us to fully experience our emotions and essentially just pushes us further down.
It was a conversation about the struggles that certain groups go through to just make themselves heard and make themselves find a way in the world. I think there was a conversation about race, about gender, about many different very pressing issues.
Just mixing this very intense, incredible artistic experience with this very, very physical act of aggression, it just sort of completely, completely destroyed me. So incredible piece and very, very much needed.
A lot of the show revolved around the armor that people put on or take off in different moments, either because they have to or because they choose to.
I'm going to cry again.
Before we go, we want to do a little plug for our wonderful guest from episode 3, Akua Jamfi. As we discussed in that episode, the British Blacklist are launching their first film festival in collaboration with Soul, We Are Parable and the New Black Film Collective. So the Soul Film Festival is taking place at the BFI South Bank next weekend on the 30th and 31st of August. They will be celebrating and showcasing black filmmakers in front of and behind the camera. So please do go along and support them.
And that's it from us for episode 4. So thanks again for listening, and join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will be speaking to Gemma Arterton about her work as an actor, activist and a producer.
Please do, as always, get in touch with us directly via email on podcast@era5050.co.uk. If you have any questions or advice or would like to support the campaign, you can also find Era 5050 on Twitter @era50_50. And we have our own podcast Instagram where you can learn a little bit more about our guests @thenewera5050. And of course, if you have enjoyed the podcast, please do tell your friends, rate us, leave a review, as it will help other people find us.
And here we go again. Our thank yous. Thank you to our producer, George Jennings, to all of our guests and audience members from Edinburgh, Joe from Civil Disobedience, and the wonders Louise, Elaine and Misha. You're all fantastic at Persistent and Nasty. And the assembly rooms for sorting us some space to record. Suzanne Diaken and everyone at the NT for the use of their studio where we are now, and to Spotlight for their continued support of Era 5050 and our podcast.
See you again in 2 weeks' time.